And now the severe beating of a high school janitor.
Mop, 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 all day long. Mop, 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 while I sing that song. Gonna wax that floor, gonna make it shine. Gonna take off the spray paint with turpentine. Hey, don't walk there, I just mopped. Hey, get off of me. That's my bucket. Let go of my sideburns.
Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Every once in a while, we'll have a show that focuses directly on issues of violence and nonviolence. Here's the first of the lot, featuring some funny and inspiring true stories of normal people standing up to the warmongers and winning, told by peace activist Kathy Kelly. In counterpoint to these, we hear social satire on the land of the free and the violent. I hope you'll stay tuned. I must confess, the institution that drives me to the highest peaks of ambivalence is the Roman Catholic Church. I grew up in a nice working-class neighborhood outside of Philadelphia. My neighborhood was half Catholic, half Protestant, and frankly, we kids didn't give a damn, and neither did the adults. But the church leadership, with the shining exception of Pope John the 23rd, they made even my old fascist scoutmaster look liberal. Mid-60s, Vietnam War days. John Cardinal Kroll of Philadelphia, fascist warmonger. Francis Cardinal Spellman of New York, fascist warmonger. Cardinal Ratzinger, longtime enforcer of orthodoxy. Before that, card-carrying member of Hitler Youth Organization. Now Pope of Rome, as the right-wing Christians refer to the office. But, on the other hand, a small but very effective minority of Catholic crusaders for peace, freedom, social justice, and fair distribution of world resources. These included clergy, such as Archbishop Oscar Romero, and, in the U.S., anti-Vietnam War leaders, Fathers Dan and Phil Berrigan. And then there's the laypersons, such as of an earlier generation, Dorothy Day, founder of Catholic Worker, and her many followers. Not she, but they, and also the Catholic Worker organization, are still alive and kicking today. Out of this grand American Catholic tradition of Christianity-based struggling for peace and social justice, often in contradiction to the latest pronouncement of Mr. Know-It-All up on the throne of St. Peter, out of this great and inspiring tradition comes our good guy of today, Kathy Kelly of Chicago, Illinois. Just a quick historical note. While Pappy Bush, Clinton, and W. were bombing, killing by sanctions and bombing, invading and bombing, and now occupying and bombing Iraq, for much of that time, Kathy Kelly and colleagues were on the ground in Iraq, witnessing, gathering information, learning Arabic, getting to know the Iraqi people, and periodically returning to the U.S. to tell the true story of Iraq, and the true story of her heinous crimes there, and to try to mobilize Americans to demand a halt to the insane bloodbath our government was unleashing, and continues to unleash. We'll soon hear Kathy Kelly speaking in Seattle, just a little while ago, in September 2008. She tells a wonderful tale of an Irish barrister and his summation before an Irish jury, when he asks a question that Kelly feels she herself ought to have a better answer for than she does.
When I was a kid, I grew up in a part of Chicago where we didn't try to emphasize diversity by any means. Fitting in was where it was at. We were all coached to try our best to fit in. So I actually didn't know very much about being Irish. And my mother's uncle came over from Ireland. And that I knew was a big, exciting moment. Mom's brother coming over all the way from Ireland. And he walked in the door, and I was very eager to see him, my little 12 or 13-year-old self. And he took one look at me and he said, "Oh, lass, you've got the map of Ireland written on your face." And I was upstairs crying for 2 hours, thinking all he noticed was my acne. We never heard of this map of Ireland written on your face business. I knew nothing about being Irish, couldn't do the Irish jig, anything. But I'd never been to Ireland. But before the shock and awe bombing, which seemed so imminent, that we were, you know, all taking measures to wrap up our computers and stick them inside of refrigerators. We had all kinds of expectations of a massive bombing. I got an invitation to briefly leave Baghdad and go to Ireland for me the first time. And I thought long and hard, you know, why should I be leaving at this point? But the Sisters of Kildare, Sisters of St. Bridget of Kildare, were mighty convincing. Ireland is a neutral country, and Ireland was being used by the United States for pit stops. And the idea of a pit stop for an airplane is you stop on the tarmac, you refuel, and in the case of the United States Navy warplanes, you also could get more ammunition, get more supplies, switch soldiers. This was definitely part of a build-up for a war effort, and there were people all across Ireland who were pretty troubled, Ireland being by its constitution a neutral country. And the Sisters of St. Bridget were praying mighty hard that maybe somehow they could advance this idea enough to interfere with the war. Would I please come and talk about the perspective from Baghdad? So the team that was there with me, we called ourselves the Iraq Peace Team, they said, "Yeah, go." And so off I went, and I gave the best talk I could. I showed the pictures that Mr. O'Kelly says he still has today, the pictures of children who were suffering so badly from those economic sanctions. I talked about women I knew who, seeing themselves kind of in the crosshairs of the world's largest arsenal, were terrified, and grandmothers tugging our sleeves saying, "Where I hide, where I hide," and men with nerves of steel saying, "Believe me, Kathy, I am so scared." Well, I gave the best talk I could, and I left, went back to Baghdad. We were able to get online on occasion, and 5 days later I learned that five people who'd been at that talk had gone out to the tarmac of Shannon Airport and did $2.5 million worth of damage to a United States Navy warplane parked on the tarmac. I didn't tell them to do it. But this was what they felt that they could do, and they'd prayed long and hard over it, and they actually saw it as a faith-based action. These were people who took to heart what's written in stone across from the United Nations and in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 2, "When shall come the day, O Lord, when they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks? Nation shall not lift the sword against nation, neither shall they continue to study the ways of war any longer." And so these five called themselves the Pit Stop Plowshares. Each year I felt like I might be the albatross for these five. I mean, how in the world could they defend themselves when they stayed and waited to face the music after they did the action? Clearly, they had done this action. Their only defense was a kind of a necessity defense and a faith-based defense. Well, the first judge had the proverbial Irish temper. You know, they wear the sheepskin wig on their heads over there and the long black gown, and I thought that wig was going to go right through the courtroom ceiling. He was so angry with them, they had to take him off the case and start all over again. Second judge, it turned out, had had dinner with George and Laura Bush on three separate occasions, off the case. So we're the third summer on one trial, and this time they landed a woman judge, and she was really quite sophisticated. It seemed like this trial was going to go through to the end, but much to my dismay, she said, "The only defense witness I'll allow in my courtroom is Miss Kelly, Well, off goes Dennis Halliday, not allowed to testify. Scott Ritter, no, it wasn't. It was one of the IVAW guys, not allowed to testify. A ballistics missile. Nobody was being allowed to testify except me. And then she said, and there will be no faith-based testimony in front of the jury in my courtroom. She was ruling out all faith-based testimony. So it looked to me as though these five had just the slimmest of chances of avoiding many years in prison. Well, the reality in the Irish courtroom is at the end of the trial, the barrister, the lawyer, can say anything he or she wants. Anything goes at the summation. And these three were quite fortunate to have these five defendants had three of the best lawyers in all of Ireland. And so it was that Mr. Nix, one of the lawyers, at his summation, faced off with the judge, and he said, the greatest pacifist of all time was Jesus of Nazareth. And the greatest pacifist document ever written was the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm about to read it here now. And he starts to read to a Dublin Irish jury the sermon, blessed are the peacemakers, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice. And so, and then he's kind of changed his tone. And he started to describe a beautiful day in a London park. He talked about sitting on a park bench and the children were chasing the ducks up the hill and the ducks were chasing the children down the hill and the children were squealing with joy. And he assured us all the most beautiful sound in any language, the universal sound of beauty, must be the sound of children at play. And then his face darkened, his voice lowered, and he was screaming at us. They're bombing children in a swimming hole in Lebanon. Children are dying in a pool of their own blood. And I was so fixated on the trial that summer, I'd barely read a newspaper. It was the summer of 2006, and I pulled over a copy of The Guardian from that day. And I think I was reading the headline that Mr. Nix, the barrister, had read on the train on the way into the courtroom. It was about an Israeli Air Force bomb that had directly hit a swimming hole where children were playing, and Abu Ishmael was at the rim of the crater that had been created, and there were little plastic sandals caked with blood and mud on the rim of the crater, and Abu Ishmael held his head in his hands and he roared with his grief, Hezbollah here? Only children here. My son here. But his son wasn't there. His son was one of three killed, seven critically injured. And so it was as though Mr. Nix had all of us on trial. He asked us, would you not try, if you could, to stop a Hezbollah missile from slamming into northern Israel? Would you not try, if you could, to stop an Israeli missile from slamming into a children's swimming canal in southern Lebanon? The question isn't, did these five have a right to do what they did? The question is, what's our excuse not to do more? What will rise you? Well, the five were acquitted on all counts. But I'm not acquitted. I feel that Mr. Nix's question is still my question, and if you will, our question. What will rise us in the face of so many deaths of the innocents? At a time when in an election season we're asked to look at someone running for president as a hero whose history was 23 bombings from a very believably safe place. Pulling the lever, one mission after another, and dropping bombs on innocent people who meant us no harm. And this is to be heroism in our time. Well, I want you to know some of the aftermath of that trial. Because when that verdict was delivered, nine other people who lived in Northern Ireland, Derry, Northern Ireland, realized that a Raytheon bunker buster had just been used in the current war that summer of 2006. And that bunker buster
went into the basement of a building where people in southern Lebanon had hid their children from the bombs. They were sure that the Israelis had nothing that could bring this house down. And so they sent the children to the fortified house, told them, tuck in here, sleep in the basement. And the bunker buster from Raytheon Corporation, Condoleezza Rice, had insisted, don't sign the ceasefire yet. They couldn't get that bunker buster over to the Israeli Air Force, because when they tried to land the plane in Ireland, because of that trial, because of those five, because of the nuns, because of the people who had protested, because of you too, really, they couldn't land the plane because the Irish courts had to say no. And they tried to land it in Scotland, and the Scots were out. Nay, nay. They finally found an old abandoned airfield in Suffolk in England, and they landed it there, and they were able to refuel and bring the bunker buster, the desirable bunker buster, to people who wanted to use it. And so it was that that bunker buster burrowed into the ground and 13 people were killed. And among them, a whole entire family lost three beloved children. Now, it happened that I went to visit that family myself. I was in Lebanon at the end of that war. And during the first 10 days after the ceasefire, we went to visit some of the families where war crimes, where massacres had been committed. But these people, activists in Northern Ireland, without having met the Shambhala family, identified with what they'd read, and they went into the headquarters for Raytheon in Northern Ireland. And they opened the windows, and they unplugged the computers, and they walked over to the windows, and they dropped those computers out the windows, one by one. I was kind of astounded. Do you know, on May 31st of this year, the Irish jury in Derry, Northern Ireland, acquitted them on all counts. Raytheon is on the run. And another group in Australia went to another Raytheon headquarters. And they also did an action of damage to property, and Raytheon has just dropped the charges. So I have to sometimes wonder, when we think there's nothing we can do or there's so little we can do, we sometimes don't do anything at all. But sometimes you see that little groups of people are able to make challenges. Now, I myself have not been able to bring myself into an action, a plowshares action. We called ourselves plowshares light when we planted corn on top of nuclear missile silo sites. We thought maybe, you know, the farmers could identify more with growing the corn. But what I want to share with you is this sense that Mr. Nixon's question grabs me, and I think I need to be grabbed on a daily basis in order to more or less walk the talk of nonviolence. So what will rise me? I'm very fortunate. I get opportunities to go and be.
Are you going, said the man at his desk. Oh, I'm going to a new world, said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. I'm going to a new world, said the child, and he stood. Oh, I'm sounding drums of war, said the man. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man at his desk.
Yes, I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood. And he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood.
I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood.
Oh, but
do you know the truth, said the man at his desk.
Yes, you lie and call it truth,
said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twere well that he stood. You lie and call it truth, said the child, and he stood.
Oh, you must be scared to die,
Weatherman at his desk. So I'm prepared and you're scared, said the child. And he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twirled well at his stood. I'm prepared and you're scared, said the child. And he stood. The child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and twirled well that he stood. It's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood. It's ringing you to hell, said the child, and he stood.
The old Pete Seeger song, The Bell, one of several interesting remixes floating around. Lead singer here is Stefan Smith, and yes, that older male voice in the background is Pete Seeger himself. Before that, a talk by the admirable Kathy Kelly, in which she explores some of the intricacies of violence and nonviolence. If anyone out of Chicago ever produces real change we can believe in, it will probably be Kelly and not some politician. Maybe because of the bloody struggles for labor rights in Chicago a century ago or so. The workers came out ahead, but not before being clubbed, shot, railroaded, hanged, and even tortured by the forces of law and order. The governor, the state militia, the Pinkerton goons. Pinkerton was the Blackwater of the previous century. They all cracked workers' heads to preserve the freedom of the working man to work 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week for 20 cents an hour. No pension, no health benefits, no sick leave, no control, and no rights. I know what you're thinking. Walmart. Yes, my friends, brothers, and sisters, as of the moment, we still have Social Security and guaranteed extra pay for wage labor above 40 hours a week and the right to organize and the right to go on strike, though the exceptions to this rule are now growing alarmingly rapidly. And in many cases, our wages have been high enough to put a roof over our heads, feed our family, maybe even take a vacation. Or at least our wages were high enough until recently. But we are comfortable compared with our equivalents a century ago. Do we owe this to the kindness and generosity of the big business robber barons and their honest, incorruptible associates in banking and in Wall Street? No, as I'm sure you know too, we owe this to workers who organized and fought back even though hopelessly outnumbered. Even though crooked governments and crooked courts used all the state power they could muster to keep the workers poor and powerless. And a large part of this battle took place in the streets and factories of Chicago. So it's no surprise that so many feisty, independent, idealistic but practical, and verbally fluent reformers come from Chicago and from other cities that were great centers of industry a century ago. New York, too, and Pittsburgh and Lowell, Mass., to focus only on the Northeast. In sum, never underestimate nice Irish Catholic girls, especially if they come from Chicago, like Kathy Kelly, or Pittsburgh, like Anne Feeney, or, for that matter, Dublin. Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the talk by Kathy Kelly, our thanks once again to Mike McCormick at Mind Over Matters in Seattle. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter the station management, staff, or the licensee, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. New World Notes can be heard by radio, by digital stream, podcast, or free MP3 download at any time. For podcast or download, just go to www.radioforall.net and do a search on New World Notes. That's www.radio4all.net. Even easier, just go to wwuh.org and find its description of this program. Then just click on the convenient link you'll find there. That will take you to Radio for All, and you're ready to listen, download any show, or subscribe to a podcast. That's wwuh.org. I appreciate your comments and suggestions. Email kdowst, that's KDOWST, at hotmail.com. If you'd like to receive weekly email announcements about the next show, drop me a line. Again, that's KDOWST at hotmail.com. Until next time, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimi non carborundum. Beat those swords and bunker busters and cluster bombs into plowshares. Drive those money changers out of the temple and keep the faith.